The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Okay. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
So my title for this talk is The Greatest Story Never Told, which is obviously the story has been told. It's been told in a number of venues, in particular in this book, Detroit, I Do Mind Dying, which to say I highly recommend would be an understatement. I feel like if the people in this room who don't currently own the book do not own the book by the end of the day, then I have failed to do my job. And to be honest, like it was tempting to not just, you know, not write a talk at all and just make this like socialist story time and just have me read to you all, gather on the rug, you know. It's an incredible account. And of course, the people who carry the history of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers tell the story. And there's a number of collections of their oral histories and so on. But when, of course, it has to be said that the true story, the true history of the 1960s and the whole kind of history of black struggle in this country is rarely told. I mean, it's all stolen from us. But to the extent that we hear something about the 1960s, we do hear about the civil rights movement. We hear about organizations like the SCLC in the South, or SNCC. And if we're talking about the most radical edge of that era, that black freedom era, we hear about organizations like the Black Panthers, which is a very important organization. But the League of Revolutionary Black Workers is a story that is rarely told. And I just want to read what the late, great black historian, social theorist Manning Marable said about the League of Revolutionary Black Workers in the foreword to the latest edition of the book. He says, although most histories of the civil rights and black power movements give greater attention to formations such as the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, and the Black Panther Party, the League was, in many respects, the most significant expression of black radical thought and activism in the 1960s. It's a powerful statement from somebody who I think we can count as an authority on the question. So I want to get into that history, and I will quote extensively from this book, which is really an incredible account and kind of analysis of that history. So I want to start by talking about the conditions that were facing the Detroit working class at the moment. And, you know, I'm going to circle back to this at the end, but that is the question of what Detroit looks like today. Because those of us who grew up in my generation, what Detroit has come to embody is more than any other U.S. city, in my opinion, the brutality of U.S. capital, its utter contempt for the people who produce its profits, and in particular, the level of violence in any number of forms against the black population in particular. That is, when we think about black cities in the United States over the past 40 years, it's been, the truth be told, it's been a nightmare in this country for the entire U.S. working class. But all I have to do is say the names of cities, and what comes to mind when you hear the name Baltimore, Oakland, Flint, Chicago, Brooklyn, and again, in my opinion, more than any other, Detroit. What does it represent? Anybody here from Detroit? I'm not from Detroit, I'm from the East Coast. And I remember going for the first time, and one of the remarkable things about it is there was this, I'm gonna talk about it in the talk, but there was this rebellion in Detroit in 1967. You know, there was a whole series of urban rebellions throughout the 1960s and 70s. And the Detroit Rebellion was the largest, the most extensive, the one that lasted the longest, the one that caused the most damage, that resulted in the most arrests, etc. And when you go to Detroit today, there remain buildings that were burned in the 67 Great Rebellion that are still standing. The city has left them as these kind of monuments, this wreckage that that presides over a broader wreckage of the city. It is a way of saying, this is what we think of you, the skeletons of these burnt out buildings. So that is Detroit. It is Detroit that I have kind of, that I've grown up with over the course of my lifetime. But of course, in the 1960s and really in the post-war period, Detroit was arguably kind of the opposite. It was the heart of world capitalism. I mean, the United States in World War II emerges as the most powerful industrial country in the world. At some point, something like 80% of manufactured goods in the world are manufactured in the United States. So that's the kind of post-war, economic explosion. And of course, inside this country, internally, there's this huge kind of economic and social shift, the suburbanization of the country, right? Which meant the construction of highways, the construction of suburbs, of all sorts of new facilities for industry and so on. Really the redesign of U.S. cities, which has come with a whole, the neglect of those cities and so on, something that we're circling back to in a strange way now, that the very cities that have been neglected and demonized in this racist way are now desirable and being gentrified. Right? Yeah. But this is a kind of shift taking place in the United States after World War II. And the auto industry figuratively and literally kind of embodied U.S. manufacturing. Because what was the great symbol of American life after World War II? What was the great symbol of kind of a new suburban life in the United States? Well, your new Chevrolet or your new Ford car, right, or to drive to work and then drive home. And so these corporations, we'll be talking about the big three, General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler, are enormously profitable. They're churning out tons of cars and so on. And so Detroit is kind of the heart of that. And it is located in a very special way in the U.S. economy and therefore the world economy. That is, what does the auto industry require? Well, it requires the steel industry. It requires the rubber industry. Glass. I mean, gasoline. All of these things intersect at the auto industry. Okay, so that's Detroit. Now, you can, of course, go to YouTube and watch these newsreels of manufacturing in Detroit in the 1950s and 60s, and they show these great cars driving off the production line and how this represents the new American life and the American dream and so on. But of course, all of that production came with a tremendous cost for the workers who were actually doing the producing. For the big three auto companies, their concern was how to produce, bless you, as many cars as possible with as low labor costs as possible. And so they figured out a number of things. I'll just talk about a couple. One, that it was cheaper to have an existing workforce and force them to work overtime. That is, well, okay, we'll pay you time and a half, but you're going to work overtime. That was cheaper than just hiring more workers to do the labor, which means getting more benefits, etc. And so compulsory overtime became the norm by the 1950s. It was understood that on each shift you would work 1 to 4 additional hours above what your contract said. And then it was not uncommon for workers to be called in on Saturdays and even Sundays to do additional work also. So we're talking 8, 9, 10, 12-hour shifts of the same kind of monotonous, dangerous work. The auto companies conducted scientific studies to analyze the movements of the workers on the production line and figure out how to make it as cost-efficient as possible. People who are familiar with Taylorism, the kind of scientific study and routinization of labor, that's what this was about. And a worker in the Lordstown GM plant explained it really well in this New York Times article in 1973. He said, "They tell you to put in 10 screws, and you do it. Next week, they'll tell you to put in 15 screws. And next they tell you, we don't need you anymore." Right? So, that's what the work was like, and the conditions were horrendous. While the managers at the big auto companies expected things like air conditioning and heat, basic kind of things, in the auto plants themselves, those things did not exist. And so, you know, if you're familiar with the climate in Detroit, you know, it gets very hot in the summer and very cold in the winter. And auto workers would have to work in these plants that were not climate controlled through all of that. It was not uncommon for plants to have leaking roofs. And so while they're working on assembly lines, rain is dripping in and so on. They're working with gasoline and sparks are flying. They're speeding up the assembly lines, and it's not uncommon for people to lose fingers and things like that. And the concern for the supervisors on the assembly line always was that the assembly line cannot stop. We can't stop the production line. So if somebody gets injured, get them out of the way, get somebody else in there, we gotta keep it moving. The line can't stop. So there was this, and if you do go online, kind of look for these sort of campy nostalgic videos of Detroit in the 1950s and 60s, you will inevitably see at the Goodyear tire factory in Detroit, they had this thing called the Goodyear computer, which was like this enormous, kind of like a billboard, that had like moving numbers on it like an odometer. Imagine like a giant odometer. And what it was doing was counting the number of cars being produced in Detroit between the different auto corporations. And it existed at the intersection of these two major freeways in the city. And so it's always counting. This is how many cars are being produced round the clock. And it was supposed to be this kind of embodiment of pride of American industrial productivity. Well, in the year 1970, the Goodyear computer, it topped out at 6,546,817 cars. In that same year, United Auto Workers Union records indicate that there were 15,000 injuries on the job and an untold number of deaths. And so we have the number of cars that are produced, and that's counted, but there was a human cost. Okay. Now, not surprisingly, black workers face the brunt of this violence. Now, just a word about the increase in Detroit's black population and black auto workers. Now, in many ways, Detroit represents, it kind of embodies this experience of what was called the Great Migration, this massive shift throughout the early 20th century of the black population from a rural population in the South to the urban centers of the Midwest, the Northeast, and the West Coast. And in particular, during World War II, there were these labor shortages because there was this massive draft, and that opened up all sorts of possibilities in the workforce for women in unprecedented ways, as well as black workers. That is, corporations that previously were not hiring black workers were hiring them in large numbers to fill in the gap for all of the white workers that were abroad fighting in World War II. So in 1942, black auto workers in Detroit went from 5.5% to 8.8% in 1 year. And then by 1945, that was up to 15%. So almost three times the number of black auto workers over the course of 3 years. And if you break it down by a particular corporation, the rise is more dramatic. The Chrysler Corporation, for example, went from 2.5% of their workforce being black to 15%. Over the course of 3 years. And of course, there was racism in the plants as well. It has to be said that this is true throughout US industry, but the auto industry in particular had this history of using black strike breakers to attack the working class. That is, when auto workers would go on strike, in these largely white workforces, they would bring in black strike breakers to break the strikes, and that, of course, introduces division and racism into the working class. Okay, in terms of the actual breakdown of the work, it was most stark when you looked at who the supervisors were. In the Dodge main plant, for example, 99% of all general foremen were white. 100% of all superintendents were white, 90%, and so that's the kind of managerial layer. But then within among the workers themselves, 90% of all skilled tradesmen were white. That is, the more skilled jobs, which happen to be the less dangerous jobs, were overwhelmingly occupied by white workers, and then 90% of skilled apprentices were white also. There's this story, so in addition to this book, Detroit, I Do Mind Dying, there's this incredible documentary called Finally Got the News, which is made by a radical film collective and kind of collaborating with the League of Revolutionary Black Workers to really document the experience. And there's this one moment in that documentary where a white worker is being interviewed, and he talks about how the process of it being decided what work you would do in the plant was determined by tests that workers were given. And so he was given this exam, applying for a more skilled position, and he did poorly on the math part of the exam. And he said that the supervisor who gave the exam said, "Look, why don't you go home, take the weekend, study up, come back, take the test again." And he said, "Now I know they would not say that to the black workers," right? So that's kind of how that played out. There were jobs that two white workers would do in the plant that one black worker was expected to do. And again, just to talk about what that meant in terms of, the relationship of the exploitation of the workers in general, the black workers in particular, as it pertains to the production of automobiles. In 1946, there were 550,000 workers, so just over 500,000 workers, made 3 million cars. By 1970, you had 750,000 workers, which is an increase of a little less than 50%, making 8 million cars, well over twice the number. So a massive increase in productivity. And the auto companies said that this was the result of, in addition to American hard work or whatever, automation, that is technological advances. And the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement coined another term. They said this is niggermation. It's not automation, it is the exploitation of black workers in particular that has led to this incredible productivity. And that's where the name of this book comes from. It comes from a song, a blues song that was sung, I was on the radio in the 1960s and 70s, the chorus of which is, "Mr. Foreman, please don't speed up that assembly line. I don't mind working, but I do mind dying," because so many people were being killed. Okay. Let me say a word about the black struggle in Detroit, the kind of context from which the League of Revolutionary Black Workers emerged, because like the Black Panther Party, and like any organization actually, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers didn't just kind of emerge from thin air, but out of the previous years of upheaval in the black freedom struggle. And keep in mind, by this point, the civil rights movement has been going since the mid-1950s, and a number of lessons have been learned. After the Voting Rights Act and Civil Rights Act of 1964 and 65, the center of gravity of the black freedom struggle shifts from a southern struggle that's focused on legal rights and combating legal segregation to one that's more present in those urban centers in the Midwest, in the Northeast, and on the West Coast, fighting institutional racism in other forms. And as I mentioned earlier, there were so many aspects to this. There were struggles for fair housing, and the kind of housing conditions that black people were living in were appalling in city after city. There were all kinds of struggles for jobs and against poverty and against police violence and so on. And one aspect of this era was urban rebellions. Really, every major U.S. city had an urban rebellion in their black neighborhood, and a lot of smaller cities too, actually. But as I said before, the Detroit Rebellion in 1967 was the most extensive one, the Great Rebellion. And so all of this is kind of a context that fosters a number of organizations and movements in Detroit to combat racism, and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers is part of that. So a word about the League. These were Marxist black auto workers who basically had this strategy that was, if we can organize the black auto workers here in Detroit and organize things like wildcat strikes and so on, organize the black auto workers on a revolutionary basis, because of the position of the auto industry in American capitalism and therefore in global capitalism, And because of the particular location of the black workers in the production process, doing some of the most essential work, the most dangerous work, etc., if we can organize those workers on a revolutionary basis, we can launch a socialist revolution in the United States that has global implications. That was their vision. Greatest story never told. Very significant, I think. All right. The leaders involved in the League of Revolutionary Black Workers had shared histories. They tended to be involved in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Many of them were involved in something called the Freedom Now Party, which was an all-black kind of progressive electoral formation in Michigan. There was this organization, a black power organization called Uhuru in Detroit that a bunch were involved in. There was something called the Revolutionary Action Movement that a bunch were involved in. Some of them went to Cuba in 1964 and actually met with Che Guevara, by the way, which was not like legal really at the time. Some of them, a number of them, attended meetings of the Socialist Workers' Party, and in particular were part of a study group of Marx's Capital. There's an all-black study group led by one of the members of the SWP in that time. And it's just to be said, too, that Detroit was this kind of hotbed of radicalism. People may be familiar with C.L.R. James, this very important Trinidadian Marxist theorist who lived a number of different places in the world, but at one point he lived in Detroit and had a big impact there. James Boggs, who people may be familiar with, the husband of Grace Lee Boggs, these were revolutionaries who were in Detroit, who were part of kind of a revolutionary milieu in the city. And that was the milieu from which the League of Revolutionary Black Workers emerged. They grouped around a newspaper called the Inner City Voice, which was edited by one of the leaders. His name is James Watson. And to give you a sense, the kind of politics of the Inner City Voice, I'm going to read from the very first issue, which was published in October 1967. This was published after the Great Rebellion. It says, "In the July Rebellion, we administered a beating to the behind of the white power structure. But apparently, our message didn't get over. We are still working too hard, getting paid too little, living in bad housing, sending our kids to substandard schools, paying too much for groceries, and treated like dogs by the police. We still don't own anything and don't control anything. In other words, we are still being systematically exploited by the system and still have the responsibility to break the back of that system. Only a people who are strong, unified, armed, and know the enemy can carry on the struggles which lay ahead of us. Think about it, brother. Things are hardly getting better. The revolution must continue." That is this newspaper that is disseminated. Its intended audience is the black population of Detroit, though a lot of people read it. And there were a number of kind of alternative newspapers in Detroit, but this was an agitational one that's trying to put forward revolutionary ideas. They covered the conditions of the of work in the auto plants in Inner City Voice. They talked about police violence, racism in housing, etc. It featured a column by James Boggs, as well as Robert Williams, who's an important figure in the Black Power movement, wrote something called Negroes with Guns, was somebody who advocated for black people to arm themselves against white terrorist violence, was exiled from the United States and ended up in Cuba and then subsequently in China. Inner City Voice featured a regular column by this person. They also had, it has to be said, not only an outlook that took all those kind of circumstances of black life in Detroit, whether inside the plant and outside of the plant, in account, but also took into account an internationalist vision that really saw the struggle that they were waging in Detroit as part of a global insurrection. And I'll just read again from an editorial in 1968 from Inner City Voice. "To struggle in our own interests means that black people of the ghetto must struggle to overthrow white capitalism. The struggle against capitalism is worldwide, and the revolutionary struggle of the ghetto is crucial and essential in the overall world revolution. If the Koreans and Vietnamese can overthrow imperialism in Asia, then Asia will be free. But if the black revolution can overthrow capitalism and imperialism in the US, then the whole world will be freed. This, then, is our role. With this understanding, let us praise the Vietnamese and the Koreans, but let us pass the ammunition and do our thing. Okay, so they were radical. And they were propagandists. They were, as I said, they engaged with Marxist theory, and the leaders of the League were brilliant at conveying pretty complicated ideas about exploitation and oppression and internationalism and class in ways that were clear and convincing and agitational. And I just want to read a bit of the text from my favorite part of the film, Finally Got the News, which is when Ken Cockerell, one of the leaders of the League, is explaining something about industry and American capitalism. This, by the way, is the R-rated portion of the talk, some curse words. So he's talking about the people in power versus those of us who are exploited. Motherfuckers are non-producing, non-existent, motherfuckers who deal with paper. A cat will stand up and tell you he's in mining. Man, he sits in an office on the 199th floor of a motherfucking building on Wall Street, and he's in mining? And he has papers and certificates which are embroidered and shit, stocks, bonds, ventures, obligations, and he's in mining? And he's sitting up on Wall Street, and his fingernails ain't never been dirty in his motherfucking life. He went to Phillips Andover, or Exeter. He went to Harvard. He went to Yale. He went to the Wharton School of Business, and he's in mining? And the motherfuckers who deal with intangibles are the motherfuckers who are rewarded in this society. The more abstract and intangible your shit is, stocks. What is stocks? A stock is a certificate of evidence of ownership of something real. Ownership. He owns and controls and therefore receives the benefit from. That's what they call profit. He's fucking with shit in Bolivia. He's fucking with shit in Chile. He is Anaconda. He is United Fruit. He's in mining. He ain't never in his life produced shit. Investment bankers, stockbrokers, insurance men. These are motherfuckers who don't do nothing. We see that this whole society, man, exists and rests upon workers, and this whole motherfucking society controlled by this ruling clique, it's parasitic, it's vulturistic, it's cannibalistic, and it's sucking and destroying the life of the motherfucking workers, and we have to stop it because it's evil.
How can we not join that?
All right. Okay. So before I get into that, though, let me get in. Oh, wow. All right. Let me speed it up. I'm excited. All right. Let's get into what they were up against, which is a lot. So as I mentioned, there was this history of racism in the auto industry in terms of how black strike breakers were used. However, the problem was not only the auto companies, and this is really important, but also the United Auto Workers Union itself was another target of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. Now, the UAW had a reputation for being kind of an advocate or part of the civil rights movement. And honestly, as somebody who didn't live in that time and is kind of reading about it in retrospect, it's difficult to know where the kind of truth of that reputation begins and the mythology begins. Do you know what I mean? But in any sense, that was the reputation. People like Walter Roy III, who was the president of the UAW, did speak in favor of civil rights and so on. But there's also this reality of racism that plays out in the union in a structural way. And so, for example, at the end of World War II, there are 100,000 black members of the UAW, which is about 10% of the union. The elected officials of the International have about 400, there's about 400 elected officials. Of those 400, 12 are black. In a union that's 10% black. So just to give you some indication. But truthfully, or rather, I would argue that the racism of the UAW should be seen in the context of a broader conservatism of the UAW, actually. That is, it's not the case that it was doing great, you know, in this kind of progressive, organizing, radical mission, but had this misstep on the question of racism, but rather it had conservatized from its heyday. I mean, if you know the history of the struggle of auto workers in this country, and the UAW in particular, you know about the Flint sit-down strike in 1936. I mean, the UAW used to be on the cutting edge, the vanguard of the whole U.S. working class. But by the end of World War II and into the 50s, and then certainly by the 60s, they were on a different track entirely. And really, the UAW was leading the way in terms of collaboration with American capital. They had really accepted what was the kind of dominant maxim of that time, which is that what's good for General Motors is good for America. Right? That was what was put forward by General Motors. That's what was put forward by the U.S. government. And the UAW basically said, we are doing our part to help what's good for America. UAW was very reluctant to lead strikes in that regard, and they would discipline workers for leading wildcat strikes. Instead, they forced workers to submit grievances in this kind of drawn-out process where they would have to go to a union representative, fill out a written grievance, and then that had to be filed, and then that would have to be processed, etc. I mean, these are grievances for things like, this part of the assembly line is dysfunctional, or this thing is dangerous, or I got injured, or whatever. And then you file a grievance, and it has to go through this long process. And so to give you a sense of how ineffective from the standpoint of actually addressing what workers' needs the grievance system was, but how very effective it was from the standpoint of maintaining the production line. In 1970, the year 1970, there were 250,000 written grievances at General Motors alone. That's just one of the big three. That is one grievance for every two workers employed at GM. Okay. So, but that's what the UAW was about. And actually, Walter Werther, again, the president of the UAW, famously said, we make bargaining agreements, not revolutions. That is, we're happy to sit down in the boardroom and negotiate what it looks like in the shop and so on. Okay. To sum up that part, the authors of this book, Dan Georgakis and Marvin Serkin, say that when it came to car production, the auto companies and the UAW had a division of labor. The auto companies looked after the machines, the UAW looked after the workers. And they worked together, really, in that production and exploitation process. And racism was part of that. So obviously the UAW didn't do anything about the racist conditions for black workers in particular. And in fact, one of the chants that that people in the league raised was that UAW stands for You Ain't White. Okay, so I can be brief about this part because it won't be a surprise to people. One of the things they were up against was the police, who were racist, obviously. But it's worth saying that actually in Detroit, in the 1960s and 70s, Detroit had the highest number of cops per capita of any U.S. city. So, to give you a sense, and it's not a coincidence that is where production was concentrated, right? Okay. Let me say one other thing about the cops, which is, you know, the authors of the book make the point that the cops, it was an overwhelmingly white police force, and they make the point that, look, these are the children of the auto workers in a previous era whose strikes were broken up by black strike breakers. So there's a certain racist, I mean, the police are always racist in the United States, but there's a particular kind of local history to it. And then you take the Great Rebellion of 1967, where you do have a generation of auto workers who, after the struggles of the 1930s, have earned these pensions, they're doing quite well. And they see this rebellion of black people. And so the police and the National Guard are put forward as, we are the guardians of civilization against this unrest. Law and order, right? That's the police. Okay. One other thing about the police. They would, that radical newspaper I mentioned before, Inner City Voice, the cops would harass whoever printed that. They'd go to the print shops. The local police and the FBI would go to the print shops and say, why are you printing this newspaper? And as a result, Inner City Voice was never printed in the same shop twice. They had to move from shop to shop, and eventually they had to get it printed in Chicago. They had to drive to Chicago to get it printed by the same printers who put out The Final Call, the Nation of Islam paper. So that gives you a sense of the racist harassment. Okay. In the plants, there were all kinds of racist divisions. I talked a bit about what it was like for black workers. It's also worth noting, in addition to this great migration of black folks north to Detroit, there's a lot of white folks who came from the south as well. Folks from Appalachia who were not, they were newcomers to Detroit, and they were not exactly embraced. And in fact, one of the interesting things about the Great Rebellion in 67, one of the aspects of that rebellion was that cops were shot at. And when the cops would arrest snipers who were shooting at them and at National Guardsmen, they found out a significant number of them were, that most of them were not black, they were actually white Appalachians. Who knew how to handle a rifle? All right, one other thing, there's more to say about it, but just to move on, there's also a significant Arab population in Detroit at the time. These are immigrants, they're new to the country, and they're exploited as such. I don't think I need to explain further in this room what that meant, but these are the kind of divisions within the plan. Okay, what did they actually do? So the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, which is the kind of predecessor to the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, is launched out of a wildcat strike in May 1968. It's a response to a speed up. Now, the immediate gains of the strike, it's not so much in the form of concessions from the company as much as a launch into a new phase of the struggle. In fact, the Wall Street Journal, of all newspapers, ran a front page article about this wildcat strike that happened in Detroit because they knew the significance of what happens if revolutionary auto workers are organizing in Detroit. Now, though both black and white workers participated in that strike, those who were disciplined were disproportionately black. And among the workers fired was this person named General Baker. And even though I'm short on time, it would be remiss to do this talk without reading from his response, which was an open letter to the Chrysler Corporation in response to him being fired for being one of the leaders of the strike. And he actually says, "Look, I'm not, you can't say that I'm responsible for this, but I will gladly bear the responsibility. I will proudly bear that." And I just want to read from part of it. He says, "Yes, the struggle between black workers and the white racist corporation owners and operators is the most vicious of all existing struggles in the world today. It is sometimes open and sometimes closed. It is sometimes hot and sometimes cold." If you've read the Communist Manifesto, that line will sound familiar. "It is nevertheless, in the final sense, a vicious struggle. Let it be further understood that by taking the course of disciplining the strikers, you have opened that struggle to a new and higher level. And for this, I sincerely thank you." Thank you is in all caps. "You have made the decision to do battle with me, and therefore to do battle with the entire black community in this city, this state, this country, and in this world of which I am a part. Black people of the world are united in a common struggle which had its beginning with the exploitation of non-white people on a world scale. You have made the decision to do battle, and that is the only decision you will make. We shall decide the arena and the time. You will also be held completely responsible for all the grave consequences arising from your racist actions. Thank you again, General Baker. P.S. You have lit the unquenchable spark." I'm gonna skip ahead, and maybe we can get into some more details in the discussion. But let me just say, this walkout is led by something called the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, and obviously, both through the publicity by the corporate press and their own propaganda, like this open letter that was published in that newspaper, Inner City Voice, lots of people find out about it, and they form their own revolutionary union movements in other plants in Detroit as well. So at one of the Ford's plants, they form from, like drum, but from. The Eldon Avenue plant, they form Elrum and so on. And once these things form, it actually spreads beyond the auto industry. There was a healthcare workers revolutionary union movement, newspaper workers revolutionary union movement, and so on. And so they form something called the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, which is kind of a body that's meant to coordinate and organize these different revolutionary union movements. And I'll just say again what their kind of vision was, and the propaganda, which is a central part of their work. This was after the Inner City Voice was kind of discontinued as a newspaper. They ended up taking over the student newspaper at Wayne State University. That's a whole other amazing story. But they basically made it their own paper. And one of the articles said, "Drum's scope is not limited to the oppressive situation at Chrysler, nor all the plants for that matter. Although most organizing activity will be in the plants, Drum sees its long-range goal as the complete and total social transformation of society. This this will take the effort of the whole black community as well as other progressive sectors of society. So again, it's a revolutionary outlook through and through. I know that one, at least on one occasion, they printed newsletters in Arabic as well to try to communicate to Arabic, to Arab auto workers, etc. So propaganda is a central part of their work. Another part of their work is running in union elections to try to confront the kind of racist structure of the United Auto Workers. And so in 1968, they ran a slate. I'm not going to go through the whole history, but they actually run somebody to be a rep in one plant, a black member of Drum. And to people's surprise, including a lot of the black auto workers who've been working for a long time, he actually edges out the UAW's chosen, you know, worker who happens to be white. And then they have to have a runoff. And then the UAW does all kinds of maneuvers to make sure that Drum loses. They actually involve the local police department, so workers show up to go and vote. They see the police there, who are armed, standing side, you know, shoulder to shoulder with the union officials and so on. So that's all that they were up against. Okay, what happened? I mean, this is kind of the beginning of the end. So, like other revolutionary organizations, I mean, if you know the history of the Black Panthers, you know that there's this incredible armed march on the state capitol in California in 1966, and that launches the Black Panthers into prominence. And then all kinds of people want to start Black Panther chapters, and this organization sort of explodes overnight. And a similar thing happens with the Revolutionary Union Movement and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. Okay. And there's this question about, well, what is our strategic outlook? How do we actually take this thing forward? Some emphasized organizing at the point of production and spreading that all over the place. And so this is one, to quote from one sort of articulation of that position. We must act swiftly to help organize Drum-type organizations wherever there are black workers, be in Lynn Townsend's kitchen, the White House, White Castle, Ford, the Mississippi Delta, the plains of Wyoming, the mines of Bolivia, the rubber plantations of Indonesia, the oil fields of Biafra, or the Chrysler plant in South Africa. That's one sort of perspective. Another perspective says, okay, organizing the auto workers is important, but actually we need to build bridges with struggles beyond the workplace, like student struggles and community struggles for fair housing and things like that. And so there's a question about what strategic sort of direction to take, and it becomes, frankly, untenable at a certain point. And part of the problem is, again, all these people join, and while the League for Revolutionary Black Workers was so brilliant in so many ways, some of their leaders talk about the history and say, in retrospect, it was just overwhelming, right? And I just want to read briefly from Mike Hamlin, one of the leaders, and this is in an interview in 1972. He said, "We came to believe that the working class had to make the revolution, had to lead the revolution, and that we had to concentrate our energies on workers. We didn't really understand what making a revolution entailed, what a proletarian revolution was, how it took shape, how it developed. I began to feel we need to broaden our contacts with the community." And he goes on to talk about, okay, what that looked like. But then others disagreed, and so it's like, what happens when all these people join up and say, "I want to be a revolutionary," but it's actually unclear which direction to go in and what a revolution looks like and what it looks like in that moment and so on. So there was something in 1970 formed called the Black Workers' Congress, because the League of Revolutionary Black Workers actually inspired workers around the country. And they had this gathering, the Black Workers' Congress, to try to gather all these black revolutionaries and carry forward the struggle. But unfortunately, at that point in Detroit itself, those strategic differences and disagreements were such that it was falling apart internally. And the Black Workers' Congress, though it drew hundreds of people and had tremendous potential, it couldn't really go anywhere. Okay. The last thing I want to end on, or last thing I want to talk about as a way of ending, other lessons. There's a number of lessons, and I think, you know, the main one is something about the potential of workers' organization in this country, of revolutionary organization, etc. But one of the things that the League confronted is what every single chapter in the Black Freedom Struggle has confronted, which is the relationship of the black struggle to the broader working class. What about white workers? Where do they fit in? What about workers, you know, of other backgrounds? How is multiracial solidarity negotiated? Now, the League was very clear in their propaganda that they stood not only against the exploitation of black workers, but against the exploitation of the whole working class. And they said, the majority of workers in this country who are exploited are actually white. And we are against their exploitation, and we're for their liberation as well. Now, the question of how to do that, the League really, the strategy that they took was not just their own, but it was the prevalent kind of strategy of the day, which is organize the black revolutionaries, and if there are Chicano revolutionaries, be in solidarity with them, and if there are white revolutionaries, we can organize together. So together but separate, in solidarity but in separate organizations. Now, you know, I'm analyzing this from the perspective of the ISO's position and my position, which is for, well, which is two things. One, on one hand, we defend the right of any group of oppressed people to organize along the lines that they think makes the most sense. And you can certainly understand in the context of a racist United Auto Workers Union or a sexist workplace or a homophobic, so on, that it makes sense to have people organize along the lines of black workers or women workers, etc. We defend that right unconditionally. We also have a perspective that says when it comes to revolutionary organization, we think it makes sense to organize on a multiracial basis. That is the aim, is to organize people in the same revolutionary organization on a multiracial basis. So that's kind of the perspective from which I'm looking back at this. Now, the League always had white sympathizers and white allies, both inside and outside the plant. There were white workers who were excited by and sympathetic to the League. There were people like, there's this guy, Justin Ravitz, who was like this white Marxist attorney, and then later became a judge who was doing all kinds of radical stuff within the law. The person who was in charge of the South End newspaper, the student newspaper at Wayne State University that they took over, was white. He was an ally of Drum, etc. So they always had white allies and supporters. But again, the way that they approached the question of solidarity, which they were for, was through coalition. Now, I want to address this point by just reading the words from an interview of a white worker who worked in the plants. And he's talking about his experience kind of encountering Drummond. The first thing he says is, I'd never read Marx or Lenin. And the first time I read the Communist Manifesto, it was in 1969, and I thought, this is far out. They're talking about this plant. That was an important event to me. Okay. And then he says something about, he worked in the Eldon Avenue plant, so L. Rum was the revolutionary union movement he dealt with. Said, it's important to note how L. Rum related to white people. The first thing is around the distribution of their leaflets. They would always refuse to give those leaflets to white workers. It wasn't until around March of 1970 that they could respect my practice enough to give them to me. And then James Edwards would go through changes about that. He would wad them up in his hand and sort of pass them to me surreptitiously so none of the black workers would see him giving them to a white guy. When L-Rum had its wildcat strike in January 1969, there was no attempt to relate to white workers about their demands. Consequently, many of the white workers crossed the lines, and many black workers who had close friends in the white workforce took the same position. So, the approach, you know, there were some problems with the approach. And I, you know, I've read this book a few times, and honestly, every time I read it, I'm like haunted by that interview with this white worker, who's like this revolutionary, who's like, I want to be in solidarity with this organization, and I don't know how, I don't see where I fit in. And that's something that we have to negotiate. So, I don't think that, like, that is the reason why, you know, the League failed. There was a whole, I mean, the entire Black Power movement was facing a whole set of challenges, but clearly this is one, the question of how to navigate multiracial solidarity. Okay, and I do think we can look back at that with the advantage of hindsight and moving forward. I think that the argument around multiracial solidarity within a revolutionary organization is very compelling, all right? So I want to end by saying, you know, as I hope is clear throughout the talk, what the League challenged was not only American capital, but a racist United Auto Workers union as well. And I talked about kind of the process of becoming conservative, the union, but again, whereas in the 1930s the UAW was leading the way in terms of confronting capital, I would argue that since the 1960s and 70s, the UAW has led the way backwards. I mean, it really set the, what happened in Detroit set the tone for a strategy of the labor movement in general. Collaborate, concede, etc. And I don't think I need to elaborate on what a catastrophe that's been. So again, the question of race and class in that regard, these aren't separate questions. Actually, the revolutionary black struggle pointed the way forward for the working class. resistance from below, not only challenge capital, but challenge the kind of bureaucratic, ossified institutions that are holding us back, or transform them, or whatever. So what I want to end with, hope you'll join me in this, because we can look back at this history and have a critique of it, but I think it's tremendously inspiring. It's one that, frankly, we need to tell way more people about. And once Drum is launched, the people involved in launching it have tremendous pride about it. And there's this one scene in the film Finally Got the News, where people are on this picket line and they just start chanting, "Long live Drum! Long live Drum!" And so I hope you'll join me in a chant for a little bit. You know, it's like Sunday, kind of, are you ready? Long live Drum! Long live Drum! Long live Drum! Long live Drum! Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.